Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the July 27th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, my friend?
Always good. And you? You were on with Jonah this morning.
I was on with Jonah Goldberg, yeah. I think it was my sixth time on with him.
Gold jacket.
And the discussion was wonderful.
What did you guys talk about?
Inflation, economics, just, you know, rank punditry, as they say.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. He had an interesting podcast. I think it was just Saturday when he was talking about how you should run a podcast, and he was listening to somebody who had suggested you don't do any of the stuff I'm doing right now, which is, you know, check in, how you doing, although in our case that's totally organic because this is when we see each other. But he said you go right to the lead story. Now, Jonah wasn't saying that's his advice, it was the advice of others, in which case I would just leap right to the most provocative thing we've got, monkeypox, but I've got that buried in the story, unless you want to talk about monkeypox right at the top
of
the show.
I'm always hesitant to get advice from our competitors. How do we know he's steering us in the right direction?
Probably driving us into a chasm, yeah.
Isn't that like the old campaign thing of like, people are like, hey, who do you want? And they're like, well, I don't know. I mean, I really liked this candidate, but then the Democrats are saying that they think this guy's going to be more, you know, beatable, and like, everyone, getting your advice from your opponents is not necessarily the best idea.
Now, I know you can't have read the show notes, so you...
I have them up right now. Did you really want to talk about monkeypox, or was that
a joke? Well, I do, but I, you know, now that you mentioned candidates picking the opponent they'd most like to run against in a general...
Yeah.
We talked about this a few weeks ago, right before the California primary, that Newsom was trying to raise the profile of people who he figured he could beat easily, and this is a common thing. the more fascinating example, I think, most recently was Ken Cooley, who's a state assemblyman from Rancho Cordova, that's kind of eastern Sacramento County, who actually picked as his preferred candidate a guy who'd been kicked out of the Republican Central Committee because he was a proud member of the Proud Boys. And the headline here in this opinion piece that ran in SoCal News Group anyway by Matt Fleming, Ken Cooley's cynical promotion of a Proud Boys member. His point is, Matt Fleming's point is, Ken Cooley wanted to run against this Proud Boys guy because he knew he could beat the pants off him. The problem was that he promoted this guy aggressively in the primary, and then that guy was beaten by a legit Republican running against him. Josh Hoover, who's a Republican candidate running against Cooley. And so there he was, this weirdo Cooley out there promoting a guy who is a racist and saying, you know, you got to vote for me so we beat this guy. And now he's running against a guy who has done more to condemn that. Josh Hoover has condemned this Proud Boys dude. The Republicans don't want anything to do with him. So Cooley can proudly say that he spent Democratic campaign money promoting a hate candidate. A guy who, you know, we don't need to go into the Proud Boys, but not your friends or mine.
But would you say that the story is just because that's one case, but that's happening in 50 places.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If the Democrat strategy works, I don't know how many times it is. So let's just use percentages, because I think their strategy is going to work either 100% of the time or 94%. In other words, is it worthwhile if it fails even one time and you end up with one of these people who's more dangerous to the cause of democracy is what they would say. And I think they're basically right. I think all these people are insane. So my question is, you, me, people like Charlie Cook have been on the record criticizing it for its moral deficiency. But then the risk of it is, of course, that you could end up with something that you believe is worse.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, does the end justify the means? Like, in other words, if they bat 1,000, because they're going to win the Senate race in Pennsylvania. Now, that's not because Oz is one of these anti-democracy guys. He's just a terrible candidate.
Yeah, just a carpetbagger.
Trump, just one of Trump's like worst moments. Think about that sentence.
Yeah.
but the guy in the governor, okay, is a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of races we're going to lose. And the Democrats are backing the bad candidate in the primary.
Yeah.
If it works, do you feel the same?
Well, I still feel that it's ethically troubling and potentially playing with fire. Like, as you said, if one of these guys sneaks in, you kind of have a problem. And I think the more interesting story is this what Americans want out of their politicians? Is this kind of gamesmanship?
Yeah.
If it even happens on the right, where the right is picking, you know, the AOC candidate, or in California, anybody who's
so
already in the
legislature. So are we against gamesmanship, or are we against this gamesmanship?
I'm against this gamesmanship. Yeah, I think that this is really
playing. What about where you try to get another candidate to come run who's a stool pigeon just to kind of dilute the vote? And it's not that they're dangerous. You're trying to split the... there's a long history of both parties doing gamesmanship.
Oh, yeah. And that's a different kind of gamesmanship. Like, when I worked on the left, one of my jobs was to go out, and I may be preparing myself right here for a federal investigation.
You may not want to.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to say, one of my jobs was not to go out and threaten people by any stretch, but to say, hey, you know what? Here's the way the system really works. Go get on a planning commission, go get on a water district board or a school board, and then think about running for, you know, mayor of this city or state office. That was one of my jobs, and I was pretty good at it, but it wasn't to try to arm twist people out of running. If they were determined to run, they were going to run, and we were going to beat them. But that, I think, is more common. You know, and you picked this up first, and I think you were the first person to say it, and perhaps the only person to say this about Kamala, that this drip, drip, drip of bad news, which we'll come to again in a moment, about Kamala, really does appear to be coming out of liberal media with liberal sourcing on the story about how bad she is at managing, how incompetent she is in messaging, how uninformed she is on policy, that all of this is coming out of the left, not the right. I mean, the right loves it, of course. You know, you get the stuff on Fox, and again, we could talk about that in a moment, but the bottom line is that's gamesmanship, too. It's the Dems trying to clear the field. When I worked for Larry Agron, still in the city council in the city of Irvine, he ran for president in 1992, and the campaign started in 90, and I watched how the Democratic Central Committee watched Larry's terrifying rise in the polls to them, right? This is a guy who was a mayor of a city of like 120,000 in California, but he had a kind of a national reputation among progressives. He was close to Bernie Sanders and Tom Hayden and that whole crowd. And so here he is, he's running for office, and we can't get him into a debate. Why? Because the Democratic Central Committee, the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, was being run then by real kind of Clinton moderates who wanted to make sure that they didn't run into a McGovern problem again, with getting a far left candidate who was surging in the polls. At one point, Larry was like number 3 out of 7 in that year, ahead of people like Jerry Brown. But we could not get him into a debate that was nationally broadcast, which was everything, right? And as soon as he didn't appear in the Iowa debates because of the DNC, what was the guy's name? Ron, I want to say. He became eventually Clinton's commerce secretary, and he died in weird circumstances in a plane crash in Eastern Europe.
Vince Foster. Yeah, I remember.
I'm talking way too much about ancient history here, and there's real history to talk about.
No, but it's interesting. But, you know, they did solve that problem where I actually feel both sides of it, that I don't think every fringe candidate should get on the debate stage, and I think legitimate ones should, even if the quote-unquote establishment, right, my least favorite word, doesn't like them.
Right.
So what they have to do is, you know, look, I don't remember Larry being third in that race.
Before the Iowa primary.
Was it like an outlier poll? Now the polling is a bit more, you know, sophisticated. Mm-hmm. But they run an average of polls, and then they have a number.
This was not like 538 composite polling or something.
I think that's a good way to do it. And look, in 2016, it left Chris Christie off the stage a couple times, but he was coming in at under 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed on, like, it's going to be the NBC poll and this poll. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect.
No.
But I don't think it's perfectible.
No. And I also think that this is the role of parties, to go back to Jonah Goldberg, who bangs this drum often, and I think rightly. That is that.
But see, that case, though, I'm sorry, that was Democrat on Democrat violence.
Right.
What we're talking about now is Democrat on Republican violence for the sake of
protecting a
reverse
Republican
violence for the sake of winning another seat.
Yeah.
And, like, here's the thing. I would. It can backfire, okay? And it has.
Mm-hmm.
Political wisdom, you would think post-16, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, should never believe, like, oh, they better not do this because then that person can't win, because we were wrong. I was wrong about Trump, and you can be wrong about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But, like, I will say this. If I thought that Joe Biden was going to beat a good conservative Republican for president, but that if only they could nominate Bernie Sanders, then we would win the race for sure. I could see the strategy like, oh, let's really get everyone behind Bernie. But of course, the problem with that was if you're wrong, you're going to actually have a real socialist. And the to me, the risk reward there because of the humility that goes into saying, I don't know that Bernie can't win. I don't think he can.
Right.
That I would never do it. If they end up with some of these monsters that they're backing in office, it's a huge backfire.
Yes.
My concern with criticizing it on the basis of what we're criticizing it for is that once you do get hindsight, is it going to validate it pragmatically? If they bat 1,000.
Yeah. If they bat 1,000, absolutely. Everybody will do it.
It'll validate it pragmatically.
Yeah.
So you have to take the ethical ground. And then the ethical ground's tough too, because I'm not sure if I agree. Because I think there's no ethics. Nobody. I have ethics and you have ethics, but none of these people have any. They don't care. Republicans would do this in a heartbeat.
Yes, of course they would. This is what politics is. It ain't beanbag. I'm just going to stay with this idea of irony. The irony in this case being a state assembly member who's a Democrat endorsing and really pumping cash into a far right candidate from the Proud Boys. Matt Fleming, same reporter. I started digging down on the Matt Fleming oeuvre. And here's a headline of another column that he wrote. Corporate free. Alex Lee benefits from corporate political spending. Now, we have spoken a lot about Alex Lee. He's in the state assembly. He's a first term guy. I think he's in his very mid 20s, like probably 25 or 6. He's from the Bay Area. I think he's in like Fremont or something.
Are you out of order?
I am way out of order, brother. I am way down the list.
Say the name of it again.
Sure. Look at the bottom line, the irony alert story at the very bottom. Mm-hmm. I've got corporate free Alex Lee.
Yeah, I don't know how I didn't find that one. Listeners, out of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 categories, this is the second article of the 8th category.
Well,
that should have been so intuitive.
I think it's I don't know how we got on this subject, but it seemed organic in the moment. So I'm just going to say that Alex, here's the great insight into Alex Lee. He's a self-declared socialist. He's aligned himself with the most extreme elements of a very extreme state legislature. He's a very young person. And a socialist. And I think those two things, I speak autobiographically, often go together. The rare socialist like Bernie, who has, you know, should have the wisdom of decades of experience, he's impervious to that sort of thing. But Alex Lee, anyway, had declared himself and declares himself corporate free. That is, he will not take any money from any corporation. And I think Fleming's great, pardon me, the writer here, Matt Fleming, it does his best work in this piece down near the bottom of the story. He says Alex Lee got $100,000 for his campaign from the LGBTQ Caucus Leadership Fund, $100,000. And you say, well, what's wrong with that? It's a sexual orientation kind of group representing his committee. But as you might guess, in sort of the new identity politics atmosphere, who supports the LGBT Caucus Leadership Fund? Fleming finds out Chevron, the Peace Officers Research Association, that's the police union group research, Anheuser-Busch, Highway Patrol, Sempra, PG&E, Pharma, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are major corporations who are all in now on the identity politics game, and they give to this fund that sounds anodyne enough. It represents gays and lesbians, et cetera, until you realize that it's corporate-backed and that they are supporting a far-left socialist. So it's the same idea. You support a Proud Boys guy, then your Chevron you give to an organization that supports a socialist.
All right, so they don't like him.
They don't like, well, I would think they, Fleming doesn't like him, and I don't like Alex, and you and I have talked about some of the crazy boneheaded stuff that he's been involved in. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so, all right. You probably said it. I wasn't following right. They didn't give to him. They gave to LGBT caucus leadership,
right.
But he got money from them.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
I do.
Different.
This is
it's different.
It's different in this respect, but I think what's really important is not that it's that the corporations are giving to a fund without understanding who the fund gives to, and it's somebody who is antithetical.
Oh, I think they understand it plenty.
Well, they may. In which case I got to ask, you know, why is Chevron and
General Goodwill?
General Goodwill in the name of electing a socialist who is hostile to oil, hostile to big pharma, hostile to every one of their business interests, but provides cover in the giving to the LGBTQ caucus fund.
Yep.
So, and staying with that last of our sections here, I just want to point out that Attorney General Bonta. Here's the headline from Bonta's press release. Attorney General Bonta leads coalition calling for federal privacy protections that maintain strong state oversight. Now, here's what I want to point out. Bonta's part of a 10-state coalition of AGs who are going to the federal government and saying, you've got to really implement consumer privacy protections and spread, the, you know, like really enforce those things because we have people whose identities are being stolen and misused and abused. And this, I want to point out, comes from the guy who famously just leaked confidential personal identification information, including things like phone numbers and addresses and that sort of thing, family relationships of concealed carry weapons permit applicants. I think it was like 200,000 people's names were posted for a period of 24 hours. And this came right after the Supreme Court said that most of these state laws against concealed carry were unconstitutional. So this is a guy who has presided over these leaks in an administration that presided over the loss of $30 billion to scammers. Talk about, you know, lack of privacy controls or protections for our systems of identity, has given away billions to community college, hundreds of millions, let's say, $100 million, I think the number is right now, to community colleges who fell victim to phony identity scams among quote-unquote students who turn out to be overseas bots collecting cash for student aid. This is an administration, in other words, that is supposed to be policed by Bonta. They can't. As soon as they tell us that our privacy is guaranteed by Sacramento, I say, get prepared to become a celebrity. Mm-hmm. Like, they will figure out a way to screw this up intentionally or not. They are incompetent. We talked, I think, a week or two ago about the state's red flag warning system for people who have guns and shouldn't and have been declared a menace to society. And the database is so faulty, so broken, and so inadequate that nobody uses it anymore. And yet they clamor for more, you know, clampdown on gun owners. So my only point here in the irony debate is Bonta coming out and saying, like, oh my gosh, we've got to protect personal identifying information, consumers. California is a leader in this. And then, of course, we're leaking like a sieve.
Yep.
Okay, so we can go now back in order if you'd like. How about we do that? Except that I just want to...
Let's just finish the irony stuff because I can only do one category at a time.
Sure.
This is very tricky what I'm trying to do here. I keep all my my Radio Free California articles in one folder, and then we're out of order and I'm in the wrong folder.
I'm so sorry,
and,
man.
No, it's my fault.
I promised to go to the top.
This Bonta guy's an idiot.
He is deeply troubling to me.
You like the Sacramento Bee?
I you know, I'm not a person who finds a newspaper, a monolithic, good or bad. I like the Sacramento Bee a lot. I think they do a lot of very good investigative reporting. I think that one of the greatest reporters is at NPR's Sacramento station, a guy named Scott Rodd. I've talked about him an awful lot. The guy who has investigated like wildfire claims and identity theft of at government databases. He's amazing. The LA Times, all of our big papers are fundamentally good organizations that are marbled through with bad ideologues clearly running interference. Now, I'll say that, you know, I will rarely quote from National Public Radio because 95% of their stories are just run through the prism of identity politics and race, especially. But anyway, yeah, to answer your question, I do like the SACB.
Okay, so which I have a SACB article open that won't open here.
Which one's that?
But hold on, you have really done a lot of work here, my friend.
I'm so sorry, buddy.
No, it's good. I'm complimenting you.
Oh, thank you. That's also the way.
Yeah,
that
under
you...
irony, the one about California Assembly member calls for state review of DOJ data leak.
Sure.
I don't trust them.
Yeah.
Why don't you do that one? But I can't open it, and then I already have the gun maker one open.
Well, that's Jim Patterson, who's a Republican, who is saying, like, look, this gun database, this concealed carry database that was leaked for 24 hours, he does not trust the attorney general to investigate himself on this. He's supposed to, but he's supposed to investigate this leak. And Bonta swears it was a total accident and he's just outraged by this. But this is just part of a pattern of leaks. And Patterson, the Republican, in the I believe that he's a state senator, wants to make sure that you know, these guys are audited by some outside interest that, you know, is not necessarily tied to Bonta himself. What does he say here? He's got a great quote. "This is scary. I don't think the Department of Justice, that is Bonta's office, should be investigating itself. The California State Auditor should be in charge. No other investigation is sufficient." He does not trust these people. Want to go to the top?
Yeah, I guess that one, though, I would like to know prudentially what is the normal practice. In other words, my view would be either we have a bad prudential environment.
We do.
Or where there's an exception to the rule for some reason.
Well, the exception to the rule here is that Bonta would be investigating himself, Patterson saying.
Okay, but that's either true. Why would he be investigating himself if that's not the normal policy for a leak in this situation?
That's a great question. And maybe I had to call Patterson's office to find out more about that.
I would say that we may have a bad policy we need to fix where you have an outside investigator. But I would not be in favor of this just because we don't like Bonta. I think that I would be very surprised if, generally speaking, breakdowns in government offices are investigated by, now we know it can happen when it's at the governor's discretion. That's not what happened here, though, right?
No.
So like when Andrew Cuomo famously, who was the hero of COVID, you'll recall, when he famously had a political corruption investigation of people within his department, and he did the investigation himself
and cleared himself.
But he had that discretion. It was obviously dirty, and the media hammered him for it. The left-wing media hammered him for it. Mm-hmm. But in this case, there's a policy. There's a protocol.
Yeah.
And I don't think we generally have governmental investigations where the person being investigated isn't being investigated by themselves.
Right.
So either that's happening here and it's not supposed to be, and Patterson's right to call it out.
Sure.
Or the entire protocol is effed up.
From what I've read, and this is going back over a couple of weeks, from what I've read, this investigation is being carried out by the Department of Justice, by Bonta himself, because he believes this was a mistake. If you start with that, like, hey, it's just a mistake and I'm just going to perform an investigation of my own department, that's a way of fending off the criticism of somebody like Patterson, who would say, no, you're not doing any audit. You stop. And let's bring in an outside auditor like the independent auditor of the state of California, which has been a really good office and almost invariably ignored in applying its findings in a meaningful way. So I could go on, but I think the process is Bonta is saying, no, just a mistake. It was an error. And I'm going to find out who committed this terrible, grotesque error in updating the information. They hit the wrong button. That's all it was. He's kind of downplaying it. Prior to investigation.
Gotcha.
All right.
That's fair.
I want to do one quick history note here, David, and it does not involve John Sutter, but it starts with a news story, and then I did find this one on NPR. Here's the headline: "A floating abortion clinic is in the planning stage, and people are already on board." Get the pun. So Roe v. Wade is overturned, and Meg Autry, an OBGYN and professor at the University of California, San Francisco, has been mulling over the question of whether you can offer abortions at sea outside U.S. territorial waters. Like, let's say 3 miles off the coast of Texas in the Gulf of Mexico, could you put a ship out there, get people out there to get abortions? Mm-hmm. And they're very quick to say in the story, this OBGYN is, and other things like contraception and, STD testing and that sort of thing. It's a fascinating story that begins with her being raised, I think it was Louisiana, Mississippi, where she saw casino boats. You ever been down there to that part of the world? And like, I was in Mississippi and I was, where was I? Tunica, it's called, Tunica County up by Memphis. But along the Mississippi, you see these old school river boats that are permanently anchored in the water, and you go out a gangway kind of a thing. And you go out and you can, pull the lever for these on these casino boats.
But they don't do a lot of baby killing on those boats?
They don't do any so far as I know, no babies are killed, although there's a lot of smoking and drinking when I went out there and people pulling oxygen tanks behind them with tubes up their noses to go gamble.
So we already have a lot of boats where you can get pregnant.
We got boats where you can get pregnant.
But we need some boats where you can
end that pregnancy.
These are the stories that I think pro-life cynics, not constrained by ethics, would make up as a way to try to make the other side look bad.
It really does seem almost like a Babylon Bee story.
Yeah, but that's often the case about the just the silliness and the idiocy that we run into. This is like dark.
Yeah, it, David, I'll tell you,
come on board.
We will perform an abortion. It's the whole subject of abortion. I get it is nuanced, and we are often fighting over fringe issues like, and I'll say that the 10-year-old girl in Indiana who we find out is raped.
Yeah, okay.
And then we start arguing about those kinds of stories rather than the majority of cases where most Americans would agree. In any case, all of this putting abortion services on a boat. With the guidance of this OBGYN from the University of California.
Why is it they think this would be legal if it's an American boat at American dock that goes, I mean, this global waters thing, the legal argument, I assure you, is absurd.
Well, but that's why I want to talk about this historically, because what she's saying is, look, I see this with casino gambling, therefore we could do it with abortions, just put them on the water. Now, the counter argument,
the casino boats still have to go through permitting and approvals.
Of course they do. And they are frankly docked right on the Mississippi River, which is a navigable
water. Why don't they
water.
Just go to the Department of Maritime Abortion Procedures and get this approved with the necessary officers? They have you.
Will these babies? Never mind.
I don't even want to.
But here's the historical thing that I wanted to bring back to California, because it reminded me that in the 1920s and 30s, you've got prohibition raging, gambling is illegal, and organized crime associates, started buying up ships, timber carrying ships out of Canada. They would buy these massive ships, freighters, and they would retrofit them to be gambling and drinking places, right? So they would go pick up hooch in Canada and then come down the coast, pick up a bunch of people who are in LA, including movie stars. And they would bring them on these ships. They'd float out just beyond the 3-mile limit. And then they would offer gambling, drinking, and other kinds of prostitution, is alleged, drugs out on these boats. And they were primarily aimed, this is in the era before Vegas becomes huge. And the argument back then was, well, Vegas grows out of this, because you see all these Southern Californians who want to drink and want to gamble. And then in August of 1939, Attorney General Rob Bonta's predecessor, Earl Warren, our listeners will remember Earl Warren, who famously goes on to the Supreme Court ultimately, the Warren Commission, the Warren Court. And Earl Warren launches a massive, almost like naval attack. It's described in a couple of history books I remember from my grad school days as something like a naval battle. They sent all these ships out of the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And these guys, these speedboats went flying out at the SS Rex, was the biggest of these ships, run by this guy named Tony Carnero, who was born in Italy. And he is known as the Admiral because of he runs this fleet of gambling and prostitution ships, right? Drinking. And Earl Warren's guys go out there, and it is like guys wearing fedoras and trench coats, and they're swinging axes and firing weapons. There are machine guns on these gambling boats that are permanently manned 24 hours a day. These guys go rolling up, and the fire hoses are turned on. There are gun battles. There's, you know, people beaten up and people screaming. You can imagine, you know, the clientele. Including Hollywood celebrities who used to frequent these things. But it was really aimed at the middle class. They served 1 million customers in their first year, you know, in 1938. So Warren's guys attack. They destroy this thing. And it's just a phenomenal story of how a well-intentioned government law, that is, you know, prohibition, we're going to stop all the alcoholism that's raising through our society, and gambling must be illegal. And then people find a way around it. And the way around it this time was the strategy of just selling these services more than three miles off the coast of California. And as I say, it ends up in what is then called the Battle of Santa Monica, or the Battle of Santa Monica Bay. So just a quick historical note. Remember the Battle of Santa Monica Bay, my friends, as we work so aggressively and assertively to find a way to escape state and federal law. I'll put that story in the show. There's a great story in the show notes from Daniel Miller at the LA Times, and he wrote this, I don't know, like 10, 12 years ago. I'll put that one in. It's a quick read and really just kind of bracing. Needs to be a movie, The Battle of Santa Monica Bay. All right, let's talk about Gavin Newsom, shall we, David?
Let's do it.
Yeah. So Gavin Newsom, of course, finally succeeded in trolling the state of Texas by introducing a new gun law that weaponizes every citizen in Newsom's battle against illegal gun ownership. What he does, of course, is to offer anybody the right under the color of the state, of California, the state, to go out and sue anybody who's involved in any way in illegal gun trafficking. Newsom, of course, is doing this primarily as a way of telling he's really, and the left loves this. The left loves this because he is trolling the Supreme Court, trolling the Texans, and saying, like, look, if Texas can, under its abortion law, Senate Bill 8, if they can allow private citizens to go out and sue doctors or other healthcare providers who may be involved in an abortion, well, outrageous, that's illegal, unconstitutional. And then he drafts a law built on that same unconstitutionality, uses our resources to defend it. He will in court. It's his way of trying to get the Supreme Court to say, look, you got to ban what Texas is doing. We've talked about that issue at length. You have decried the fact that Newsom can, on the one hand, declare this unconstitutional and then write a law that he has already said is unconstitutional. That would seem impeachable.
You would think.
You'd think. It would certainly seem to be the impetus for a recall campaign.
No, in fairness, he could say, I changed my mind.
He's not saying that, though.
Yeah.
In fact, the law includes a trigger, a kind of a sunset provision, which says if Texas's law is declared unconstitutional, then our law will become unconstitutional. We will abandon it.
Well, yeah. So that then, that's interesting. That undermines the whole thing to begin. Like, it's just not how lawmaking is supposed to be done.
Is it unethical or criminal?
Where are the serious people?
I blame the voters. And if you read the comments when Newsom tweets about this stuff, it is amazing what separate universe they live in, where this is considered...
People don't understand how good of a chance there is this guy is going to be our president.
I completely agree. And there are apparently a majority of California voters who would be totally cool with that.
Well, I think there's potentially a majority of Republican voters apparently would be cool with it because they seem determined to nominate Donald Trump.
Yeah, there you go. Here's Newsom on Friday. You and I are recording Wednesday morning. If Texas, are going to use this framework to put women's lives at risk, and the they is Texas. If Texas is going to use this framework to put women's lives at risk, we're going to use it to save people's lives here in the state of California. That's the spirit, the principle behind this law. So the spirit and principle is if they can do an illegal thing, I'm going to do an illegal thing. That's Newsom's new principle. And you know who's opposed to this bill? The ACLU. They immediately decried it. They joined a bunch of gun groups and said, quote, "We admire and share the governor's commitment to reproductive freedom, and we do not take issue with his legitimate concerns about the deadly proliferation of illegal guns. But there is no way to, quote, take advantage of the flawed logic of the Texas law." And that's so they are going right to the principle, which is increasing.
Which is what they say you're supposed to do, yes, is be consistent,
right,
in a philosophy, even when they are in gross violation of what I believe about the right sides of certain issues. Mm-hmm. It is not what the ACLU has been doing for a number,
right,
of years now.
Right.
So that's good for them.
Yeah, this is one of those rare moments where the blind ACLU pig can find an acorn.
Shout out to our homies at the ACLU.
All of them listening right now. And our two friends in Uganda.
Two friends? What are you talking about? We're huge in Uganda.
I thought we had two listeners.
No.
Or was that our joke?
We were ranked number two, I think.
Oh, was that it?
Or was
it
like 20? 20.
Hey, Uganda. So Gavin Newsom also here. Here's a headline from the aforementioned Sacramento Bee. This is by David Lightman. Gavin Newsom versus Florida continues, this time over unemployment rates. Lightman writes that Florida's GOP is firing back at Newsom. You'll remember that a couple of weeks ago, David Newsom spent like $100,000 out of his reelection campaign to go after DeSantis and talk about how lousy a state Florida is and that people should come to California, the land that loves freedom. So the Republican Party, Florida here, I believe it is running a campaign that says, you know what? Their campaign was really simple. It was an email. And the email basically said, California's economy is in total disrepair. It's spiraling downward. They're talking about unemployment. The reporter tries to argue that, well, you know, California does have a problem with unemployment. That's only because of COVID and because we're so dependent on tourism. Now, COVID hit both Florida and California. Florida is also, like California, heavily dependent on tourism. So throw tourism out the window. And let's just talk about the fact that Governor Newsom shut down Disneyland, of course, and other major theme parks, shut down churches, et cetera. Schools closed longer in California and opened later than anywhere else in the United States of America. You don't get to blame that on COVID. Everybody, you know, the rain fell onto all alike. And whether you're rich or poor, Florida or California, the COVID rain hit. And Newsom's response to it was just terrible. And this seems to be the point of the it's the National Republican Party. And their email said, you know, there's a failed Democrat governor. Gavin Newsom really wants to be compared to Florida. Based on today's new state jobs data, that comparison, Newsom is likely to regret that comparison. And it goes on to point out that Florida's economy is far stronger than California's.
Who wrote it?
The Sacramento Bee Reporter. Oh, who wrote the email?
No, that piece.
The article is David Lightman at Sacramento Bee. And I'm just pointing out, like, I think the story is an interesting one. But if you read between the lines, he's sort of trying to excuse California's poor jobs performance. He even says, you know, California had the strongest jobs recovery in total numbers. But if you look at something like percentages, Florida and most states in America outperformed California economically in the recovery. We had dramatic employment growth in California, I'll call it post-COVID. In part because we had shut so many people out of the workforce. We had just made everybody stay home. And if you have 100%, I'm just caricaturing this, but if you have 100,000, you know, if you have 100% of all your workers locked up at home and not working, and then you open up the economy and 90% of them go back to work, that's a big number. Yeah. That looks really great. But you start by shooting yourself in the foot.
Yep.
Newsom's also running.
All of this is so easy, though, to avoid what's called base effect, which is what you're referring to. That by comparing a current number to a previously bad number, you get a distorted view of reality. Every bit, whether it's national data, economic data, California comparisons, Florida, all the different things that can happen here, all you have to do is just compare to 2019.
Yes.
So you have an even playing field of pre-COVID normalcy.
And this is called the base effect.
Yeah.
I like it. So it's the base being where you choose to start collecting your numbers.
Right.
Oh, I like that, David. Going to pretend that phrase is mine from now on. The base effect. All right, let's talk about Kamala. We'll move on here.
Speaking of the base effect, the next vice president is going to look really smart.
If he or she has a pulse. Here's the headline from Fox News. Kamala Harris goes to a press conference. Headline is, Twitter blows up over Kamala Harris introducing herself with she and her pronouns and a description of her clothing. So this is for real.
No, it is not real.
It is for real.
No, it is not real.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Was she making fun?
She was not making fun. I thought for a moment that she was just joking. But this was a conversation about the impact of the Supreme Court's decision in Roe and its effect on disabled people. And the argument from Kamala Harris's team was, of course she introduced herself as here's her intro. I'll just read what she said. Good afternoon. I want to welcome these leaders at the White House for coming in to have this very important discussion about some of the most pressing issues of our time. I am Kamala Harris. My pronouns are she and her. I am a woman sitting at the table wearing a blue suit. She's also wearing a mask. Now, her staff say that she encouraged everybody else around the table to do the same. What's your name? What are your pronouns? And what are you wearing? You know, describe your appearance today.
So she was asked.
So she asked all these people to come and talk about Roe and its impact on disabled people. And then she asked the people at the table to follow her example of name. Your pronouns and what you're wearing.
This is so bad.
Here's their defense. Okay, I just want to fair. Their defense, Kamala's team, said, look, this is for disabled people, and they can't see. So we want to be really clear about describing who these people are. Which made me wonder, like all those days I spent working in my parents' backyard and my grandfather would show up, bring the radio out and put on Vin Scully so we could listen to the Dodgers or the USC game.
Your grandperson.
My grandperson, sorry. My not able to carry a child grandperson. Thank you. But he would bring the radio in the backyard and we'd listen to the Dodgers game while we were working on, I don't know, sprinklers or building a fence or whatever. Or he loved listening to golf. Under no circumstances did I say this is unacceptable to me because I can't see them. I can't possibly just listen to this conversation and understand what's going on. How do we get along listening to music without having the artists introduce themselves, what their pronouns are, and what they're wearing? How do we listen to news on how do we listen to this podcast? David is wearing the most beautiful pink shirt today, by the way. I just want to point out. So that was her argument. It was just an absurd moment. Fox and people on Twitter had a great time with it. But this idea that somehow...
So I'm going to do something I don't normally do.
Please.
This is just fair game. This is absurd. No defense. These are the things that make me think she doesn't even want to be president. It's just brutal. It's sad. It's funny. But you know what? I did not know about it, but it turns out that someone on the right gave a great moment last night as well. And at first I thought it was a joke, and I looked it up on Twitter. So apparently there was some... one of these kind of crazy MAGA Q type people running for Congress somewhere, I don't even know her name, who was tweeting the thing about going to debate about pronouns.
Right.
And said there's no pronouns in the Bible.
Oh, dear.
Okay, well, now, obviously, if what they meant was the Bible doesn't say you can mispronoun yourself, which I assume is what she meant.
Probably.
I have no problem with that. I would agree that this mispronouning is absurd and that it would not have a biblical foundation to doing so. But she didn't say that. So then people decided to push and said, like, what do you mean? Are you saying the Bible doesn't use pronouns? And instead of, like, condemning mispronouning, she started going on this whole bit, like, no, all, like, pronouns are bad. And then someone said, can you tell us what a pronoun is? And she wrote back, ask Satan.
Oh, my. No.
Yes.
This is not possible.
Yes. So I don't think it's fair to tell Kamala's pronoun story and not tell that one.
I love it.
Because you and I are living in a world where we both feel homeless at times.
Yes.
And these are the reasons why.
Yes.
Because no, I'm not going to support Vice President Kamala Harris and her nonsense. But this other stuff is pretty funny.
Well, this is why...
The difference is she's a fringe idiot and Kamala's the VP of the country.
This will be my third reference to Jonah Goldberg, which is, I think, our max. And then Brian rings a bell and prohibits me from using a reference to Jonah, including a pronoun. But, I think this is why he talks about the radical center, you know, that there are, I think, a majority of Americans on almost every major issue who fall somewhere close to a kind of agreement, a majority, whether it's on abortion or war, or you name it, taxation. I think most people fall somewhere along that middle. And I know there are folks on the right, and even, you know, perhaps some of our listeners, and I'm sympathetic to this issue, who will say, well, wait a minute, the other side is worse than we are. Yes, I agree. They are the greater threat. But there are folks on our, quote unquote, on our side, or who at least carry the flag of our side and then do stupid stuff. And you just called it out. I think that human stupidity is, and I love quoting Solzhenitsyn's idea about how evil runs through the heart of every human and is not limited somehow to gender, race, ethnicity, land, whatever, class. It is original sin is the notion that we bring into this, that we're all broken, we're all fallen.
Of course, I agree. The pronoun thing, though.
That's good.
It's good.
Ask Satan. I'll do that.
But, like, this, first of all, the idea of just getting into, like, controversial territory and stuff to have ask Satan.
Yeah, I love it.
Default is a great line. Like, are you for raising taxes? Ask Satan.
Let's ask Satan.
But then the other piece about pronouns themselves being bad is just awesome.
I love it. Clearly not a person who had Sister Carol as his or her eighth grade grammar teacher.
What are the percentages? I don't trust I don't have a finger on the pulse of pop culture. I mean, I'm the last person I trust. I don't care. I'm a coastal elite, as they say.
There you go. Two bi-coastal elite.
But my question is, what is the percentage of people that are serious about this pronoun thing? When I get emails from people at an elite university, a media reporter, corporate, like Fortune 500 companies, I just assume it's the virtue signaling Pharisaism of our day. But that is totally asymmetrical to reality.
Yes.
So you have people with 99% of the power and prestige that represent 1%. But what's the real percentage of people that are like, look, I'd prefer to know kind of how you want to be identified as I look at you and see exactly what's going on here. I just would like to hear you tell me, are you a he, him, or a they, she, or a whatever? I don't think it's 1%.
It can't be. But I'm not a statistician.
Like 330 million people in America. So 1% of that would be about, what, 10, 12, 20 million. So look, don't talk to me about math. Ask Satan.
Let's ask Satan.
Like 3.3 million. Are there 3.3 million people? I'm being dead serious. Yeah. Are there 3.3 million people? I don't believe there are.
No.
That take this nonsense seriously.
Or Latinx. Yeah.
Yeah, but that we know is low because there's polling from Latin, yes, from Latin, from people Spanish in the Hispanic community. But like I'm saying on the pronoun thing, 3.3 million people is a lot of people.
Right.
And if it isn't 3.3, then that means we're talking about something less than 1% of the country.
Well, it may just be the circles I travel in, but I don't have anybody. I mean, I get emails just as you do from people who, you know, you can tell where they're coming. And it frequently is people like, you know, reporters or government bureaucrats. In California, I get letters from
a lot of reporters.
A lot of reporters. I get email from, you know, government agencies responding to requests we've made, and you'll find that buried in their stuff. And this is at the county level, the school district level, whatever. And they include their pronouns helpfully, as if I cared about, you know, their pronouns. All I want to get are the records that I requested through the Public Records Act, for instance. I do want to talk about one, you know, more serious story about Kamala, but it's really just a kind of a reprise of this common problem. The headline here in The Hill, that's the big D.C. Newspaper, revolving door creates questions and complications for Kamala Harris. And the only reason I'm bringing this up again, David, is just to, again, underscore the fact you said it first. The sourcing on this article is only from people inside the Democratic Party, and specifically people who are trying to trash Kamala Harris. I really do think more and more the evidence just piles up. You're right about this. This is an attempt to make sure that she's, I think they're betting Biden will not run in 2024. And if he does not, they want to make sure that Kamala Harris is not in a position to win. And this story just really eviscerates her. The revolving door has made headlines during Harris's tenure, creating a narrative only. That's The Hill, right? I noticed the word, creating a narrative, not the reality. It's just a narrative.
People say,
yes, reportedly, creating a narrative of instability in the vice president's office. But some Democrats worry about larger implications, particularly if President Joe Biden chooses not to run for re-election. And they're talking most recently about the vice president's domestic policy advisor, Rohini Kosoglu, and I'm sorry.
Can I interrupt?
Of course you can. Please.
The people say joke I made about the sources, and your point is where you're going with this, but we had just done the pronoun thing. It's been a thing I've said forever. It's never gotten traction, but there was a friend of mine in high school, I don't remember his name, we used to talk about whenever they say,
mm-hmm.
Who's the they?
Who's they?
That's the one time I will be critical of pronoun use.
Right.
Don't tell me they say. Who's they?
Yeah.
If you mean the media, you don't have to be more specific. That's good enough.
Sure.
But the they, we do it all the time.
Right.
And if you could say it's a figure of speech, no, it's unacceptable. It is so ambiguous as to be actually counterproductive.
Right.
And this, and reporters are doing it for the very reason we're criticizing it.
Yes.
It's so that you can you can establish a little bit of kernel of truth without having to have any burden to go to go there with. You should have to prove something.
Right.
Well, no. They say, you know, yeah, it's reported and people are saying.
Yes.
It's nonsense.
For our grammarians out there, the other example of that refusal to identify the actor in a certain, a very specific way in a very specific situation is to use the passive voice so that we don't have to know who the subject was creating the verb action. But I won't bore people with that. But this, you know, this just reminds me, Kamala Harris is in this difficult office to begin with. What's the old saying that the vice presidency is not worth a warm bucket of spit? In her case, it's just not even, it's like a warm bucket of shtick. It's just, this is just what she does. This whole thing with my pronouns are, or, you know, describing where Ukraine is. It's a country near another country. I mean, this is the kind of bland stuff we get out of her, but it's this constant virtue signaling, which has become a shtick with her. And again, just reading, I'll pop the story in the show notes, as always, and point out that, you know, lots of the people who are trying to derail her candidacy appear to have been associated with the Clinton administration, interestingly. And there is this tension in the story. It's really, this is by Amy Parnes, it says here on The Hill. But she really kind of points out that when Clinton went to become Secretary of State under Joe Biden, she insisted on her own people. Now this
Under
Obama. Thank you. That she
that
brought.
Deal, that deal was negotiated as part of her backing out of the campaign.
That's right. Yeah. So the idea is like, I'm going to get to bring my own. I will drop out of the race, become Obama's VP, if in fact, I'm sorry, not his VP, his Secretary of State, if in fact I get to bring my own staff to state, because I don't want to be hampered by, Obama's people looking over my shoulder while I'm doing important stuff over here.
I wish she had brought her own Libyan ambassador.
No kidding. Okay, so now we get to the story that we ought to have led with, courtesy of, I can't say his name, another podcaster you talked to this morning, but let's get right to it. Scott Wiener, you can call this the Wiener Watch, but it is really a gigantic story thanks to the media clanging the banging on the drum here. But it's the headline is, we need more monkeypox vaccines. It's from Scott Wiener's Medium campaign, platform account. And Scott Wiener, of course, Bay Area state senator behind just absolutely crazy laws. While Rome is burning, he's really working to make sure that drugs are more readily available in San Francisco, et cetera. This one is, we need more monkeypox vaccines. Now, what I'm intrigued by increasingly is what I think is going to be the short-lived candor about who's at risk from monkeypox. Have you been following this?
Yeah.
I listened to Fauci yesterday talk about this. And again, on NPR, I listen broadly and I read widely. But Fauci was interviewed on this problem, and he wanted to say, like, look, 99.9% of the cases, how am I doing in my accent? 99.9% of the cases involving monkeypox are men having sex with men. I should have issued a listener warning. If your children are in the car, I apologize. But it's listening to
what he meant to say was women having sex with women.
There you go. That's okay. I think Scott Wiener would agree. So Wiener's argument is, and here's my sense of monkeypox, that it really does seem limited to intimate sexual contact between men. And if I'm going to go with Fauci's number of 99.9% of monkeypox sufferers are men. NPR, again, interviewed a guy. I'm sorry, it wasn't NPR. It was KQED, the San Francisco NPR outlet, public radio outlet.
Yeah, by the way, I think, too, from what I read, it's that what you said, and specifically in the context of an orgy.
That could be.
That's where the spread has come. But they did contact tracing, which apparently is a lot easier to do with this kind of contact than with. And it had to do with kind of ensembles and things.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, the guy that NPR interviewed about, I'm sorry, KQED interviewed about monkeypox, he flew from San Francisco about a month ago to New York for a gay pride event and returned, and within a day had, you know, this just radical outbreak that threatened to blind him. It's apparently this virus is terrifyingly painful. I mean, like, people just feel like they are on fire. It is really, really bad. And instead of immediately coming out as he did during COVID and declaring that, you know, we have to have masking and social distancing and practice, you know, safe human interaction, 6 feet of separation, none of that. Wiener does not, in other words, ask that individuals in this community, he keeps referring to it in this piece as our community. And that's just a euphemism for, look, the gay community. Instead of saying to people, please be responsible about your intimate interactions with others. He blames it on the federal government. He says, sadly, as monkeypox is spreading throughout the country, San Francisco has the most cases in California, more than LA County, which has 10 times our population. This is yet another public health failure currently harming gay and bisexual men as well as transgender people. But if this failure continues, it will spread beyond this community. Indeed, if this outbreak is not quickly contained, monkeypox may become endemic. And who's to blame for this? The federal government. In 2019, we had a safe and highly effective monkeypox. Again, I'm quoting here. Monkeypox-specific vaccine was approved by the FDA. Sadly, however, the federal health authorities badly dropped the ball, ordering too few doses for the national stockpile. The federal government has to, you know, increase its production of this. Our nation was caught flat-footed, chaotic lines at vaccination sites, vaccine clinics canceled due to lack of supply. I could go on. David, it just reminded me of Crisis of Responsibility. Mm-hmm. There is no point in here or anywhere that I've been able to find. I looked through, I think, 12 articles where monkeypox and Wiener were, you know, connected in my search. Wiener has never said, hey, everybody, let's just pants up and, you know, mask up. Just keep your clothes on. Let's practice being monogamous. But it is just a shocking oversight of the simplest non-government intervention imaginable.
Yeah, I would say my friend Eric Erickson wrote a really great piece on this the other day.
This is the Red State guy, right?
He used to be a Red State a long time ago.
Oh, he's not anymore?
No, it's been 10 years.
Old. Okay.
He has his own Substack. It's very good. I read him every day.
Wow.
And I think very highly of Eric. But he had a piece on this making the exact same point you're making. You know how I feel about it, so I won't even go out there. I hate these subjects because I hate the fact that people are completely afraid to say what's going on. Here's my question.
Please.
Do you get the feeling that the Democrats don't really want to touch this either?
Yes, I do.
Because it's not, let's say monkeypox spreads more. I think they kind of know it's not going to spread a lot and it's limited in a certain thing. But I think that there's no way, you have Fauci saying what's going on. The science of this is not really deniable. And I think that they look at it like, okay, so you're going to get someone like a Scott Wiener saying we didn't do enough to stop it. But really, if we do a bunch to stop it, 99.9% of people are going to say what are you talking to us for?
Yeah.
I'm not doing that.
Right.
So I just think it's a loser for them politically. But maybe I'm wrong. I think they think it's a loser for them politically.
I agree. In part, it's because Wiener does an amazing job of contorting himself to make sure that we understand, at least by inference, that this quote-unquote failure of the federal government began under Trump. Not ordering. And remember, he's going back to data from 2019, 2020, when Trump is still in office, and he's arguing that the FDA and others, the CDC, did not do enough here to order all these doses. We were facing another catastrophic pandemic and trying to find a vaccine for that, and maybe we can't chew gum and walk at the same time or get inoculated against two diseases simultaneously. I don't know. But the bottom line is, yes, you are correct. I think if the Democrats acknowledge this is a problem, it requires them to start to talk to middle American Democrats and say that this is somehow a crisis for everybody. It reminds me of that time in the AIDS epidemic when you were still a little boy wearing your, I don't know, Monopoly Man onesie with an adorable infant-sized, toddler-sized top hat. When AIDS first breaks out, the understanding almost immediately was that this was a virus affecting gay men. My memory, and I am open to being challenged on this, my memory is, and I'll have to go back and look at the historical record, is that at the time, the AIDS community was trying to say, don't make this a gay disease. This is everybody. Everybody's affected by this. And that is always the attempt of every politician, every activist organization to say, it's not just us, it's you. You're going to be affected. Marx says this in the 18th Brumaire, that the crisis of the bourgeoisie is something that they try to universalize. That's for my friends out there who are former commies. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
Nobody else does. But the bottom line is that he's just really trying to avoid saying the most obvious thing here, Wiener is, and that is, guys, keep your pants on. All right.
I never knew you had a little Bill Danmeyer in you.
I do not have a little Bill Danmeyer in me. That's why I don't have monkeypox. Yo! Okay, Red State.
No, I'm saying Danmeyer's thing about AIDS in the 80s.
Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, I have it very clear on what you're talking about, but I was making a...
It's a subject that there is no... It's a lose-lose to even talk about it.
It's embarrassing to talk about.
No, it's not embarrassing. It's that it's the... The history of it, there's no upside. The revisionism of what happened is, not good.
Yeah. Here's a story out of Red State by Jennifer Van Laar, just a tremendous reporter. And the most important thing she does, here's the headline from the story. A study that the CDC relied upon for school mask mandates was authored by the LA County public health director's daughter, who's also not an MD. Okay, so background. Barbara Ferrer, who is the LA County public health director, is not a doctor, but she runs the public health department of LA County. She's fairly famous for being the most radical masker, social distancer, close the schools. LA County has led the nation in imposing all these kinds of protocols. And she famously worked with the teachers' unions in L.A. There are 80 different districts, but the UTLA that runs L.A., the largest district in Los Angeles, the L.A. Unified School District, had a hand in authoring this thing. So, too, did Ferrer's daughter, a younger person named Caitlin Barnes. I guess that would be obvious that she's a younger person if she's her daughter, Caitlin Barnes. And Caitlin Barnes is also not a doctor. Here's the problem with the story, and I say this with respect for Jen. I think she's a tremendous reporter. This is part of the story is just not important. I don't care that a person is credentialed necessarily. I really don't. Like, I think America is over-credentialed. I think having a teacher's credential is bogus. It does not teach you the most important things you could learn from, I don't know, being a camp counselor. That is classroom management. Our results speak for themselves. We have a bunch of credentialed people who are churning out inadequately.
I think it's worse. I think it puts focus on methodology over content. That's my biggest criticism.
There you go.
I'm a history teacher. What's your teaching credential? Oh, I majored in history. Nah, that's
not good enough.
What does history have to do with teaching history?
There you go.
We want to know the kind of, but look, the credentialist cult abuses are far worse than teaching credentials.
Yeah, I agree completely.
I mean, there is some made up shit out there that is absolutely
licensing.
Unbelievable.
Yes, licensing.
And most of it is cronyist, protectionist.
Yes. That's right.
Nonsense.
Yes. You could argue that the bar is illegal, the legal bar, the lawyers' associations, bar.
Oh, no, I thought you meant Alcoholic Beverage Commission. Because that too.
It's anything to do with licensing. You know that in California, it takes more hours, apparently, to become a hairstylist than it does to become a teacher, for instance. I mean, we're talking thousands of hours of cutting hair before you can actually be licensed.
Yeah.
But that's a small part of it.
Do you have a podcast license?
I do not. And in fact, California and the FPPC at one point tried to license journalists.
Oh, they would try. They would do it. Anyway.
Yes. And the argument was that you had all these people out there posting blogs and they weren't really real journalists. Yeah. And therefore, they shouldn't be allowed to publish. Right. This is the state of California about 10 years ago, maybe even less, maybe 8 years ago. But anyway, here's what's really right about the story is Jen's assessment of how this document that Barbara Ferrer and her daughter, and by the way, just a shout out to Julie Hamill, who I think is an LA County parent who my organization works with somewhat loosely, but she's awesome. She's an attorney. She's a parent. She is the one who brought this story to my attention. And this is where it gets really remarkable. This is the sort of, and I'll just call it deep state because that's a reference almost everybody knows, but this is a person who runs a powerful county agency that creates a white paper that endorses all of her protocols in the COVID lockdown. And that goes to the CDC, which points to this story. Rochelle Walensky in a press briefing mentions this as, you know, these are the things that really work. Look at how LA County shut down its schools and limited transmission among school children. The fact is these school children were going back out into the community, you know, their own homes, their neighborhoods, their friends' homes, and the community level of transmission, she says, was higher than it was in schools. Well, yes, because your schools were closed. But as soon as those kids went out into the so-called community, out into the wilderness, the wilds, they got sick at the same rate everybody else, you know, all other kids did. But the bottom line was kids were never at risk of getting and transmitting disease the same way that older Americans are. And this bogus report became one of the weapons in the arsenal with which the CDC endorsed nationwide protocols that were just like California's. Fortunately, we live in a federalist society in a lot of states like Texas, like Florida, just said, you know, we're going our own way. And we've already talked about the economics of that decision. So I'm going to skip, David, a quick conversation here about Rivian, except to say that Rivian, the Irvine-based car company with manufacturing facilities in Georgia, is rolling out Amazon EV vans, that's electrical vans, with the major goal being that Amazon has invested in Rivian. And now they're buying Rivian's products. This will help, of course, spur the market. I just thought that was an interesting kind of investment for them to make, and I was hoping for more of your leadership on this one, but I see that we're getting running late here.
And I don't have a lot of info or point of view on that.
Okay. Can I ask you, though, to take one look at me, one look for me. The last story that I really want to talk about is CalPERS recorded a kind of record loss here of $29 billion on the year in its stock portfolio, the worst performance since the Great Recession. And
I think that's their fiscal year, which would have been from July 1 to June 30.
You're correct.
Yeah.
And that's not incredibly a shock, is it?
What's the percentage?
It was down. Here we go. A drop of 6.1% for the fiscal year.
That's pretty good. It's that It's down a lot more than my clients are, but the difference is that they have so much of private equity that you don't have a real liquidity. It's what we call mark to market. But, you know, NASDAQ from its top, which was in November, is down 30. The S&P calendar year is down 20 since, but again, so it's off the calendar because they have a fiscal year. So it's not good, but it could be worse. But the difference is that we've talked about this several times. They moved to an illiquidity emphasis that enabled them to skew mark-to-market reality. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but my point is that if you don't really know what the performance is because 40% of the portfolio doesn't have an active market, doesn't have a price discovery.
Got it. I understood about 25% of that.
Okay. What I'm saying is that it's not good, but it doesn't really tell us everything.
Okay. I would love to go on because there's more economic news, but we can handle some of that next week. Is that okay?
I'll talk about economic news anytime you want.
Except this time.
No, I would have done it today too, but
but I was talking about casinos.
An hour and 15 minutes later, unfortunately, I got to go back to work.
Then that's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions. That's where a lot of these stories came from. Thanks, y'all. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us. And please do, like seriously, you can tweet at us at the Radio Free CA. I have a staffer who is standing by to respond to your at the Radio Free CA tweets. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bonson, we give thanks as ever to our show producer, Sarah Schutte, and Glenn Hall, who is one of our in-studio producers, Brian Tong, all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa la semana próxima.